Good evening and welcome back to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTO News Juneau 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. We've got a great show coming up tonight. In the first part, I'll be interviewing Dr. Kevin Crine, co-owner and lead guide for Alaska Powder Descents, as well as associate professor of philosophy at the University of Alaska Southeast. Then at 7:30 in the second half of the show, I'll be talking with Katie Hurley, a member of the Alaska Women's Hall of Fame, for her dedication to public service for over 60 years in Alaska. She'll actually be turning 92 at the end of this month. I want to remind listeners, if you're out there, you can find Alaska Identity Project on Facebook. You can like the show and stay up to date with the weekly interviews. You can also go on Twitter at Alaska ID Project and follow me there. Or go on my blog, adrienchile.blogspot.com, and there you can find the recordings and pictures of all the guests that come on weekly. Dr. Kevin Crine is a lifelong Alaskan. He is co-owner and lead guide for Alaska Powder Descents, as well as associate professor of philosophy at UAS. He received a PhD in philosophy at the University of Toronto and a BA in English and philosophy at Willamette University. He's been guiding and teaching outdoor courses in the Juneau area for the past 8 years. He regularly guides and does kayak trips in the summer months, and during the past 2 years was lead guide on Juneau Icefield film shoots for the Discovery Channel and BBC. Kevin has also been employed at the University of Alaska since 1999. From 2001 to 2007, he served as director of the university's outdoor studies program. He's also taken students on many winter ski traverses to places like Mount Bona, Mount St. Elias, Mount Sanford, etc. He holds a PhD in philosophy, which I just mentioned, but also teaches philosophy courses and publishes in the field of philosophy and sport. Some of his trips, the exciting ones, which we might get to talk about tonight, include climbing Aconcagua, two separate rock routes on the Mendenhall Towers, and participating in ski trips to Japan, surf trips to Mexico and Costa Rica, etc. Kevin.
Yes, hi.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Crine.
Thanks.
Speaking of Japan, which you mentioned here in your bio, you were skiing there when I contacted you, actually, to first be on the show a couple months ago.
Yeah. I was there in December for a few weeks skiing with some friends that work professionally as guides there.
So. All right. Have you been going over to Japan for a while?
Yeah. When I was 21 years old, I was there for 2 years. And I lived in Sendai and taught English right out of undergraduate university. And then didn't go back for a long time, but kind of maintained ties a little bit. And then Bill Glued from Juneau, who's a local avalanche guy.
He's a snow scientist, right?
Yes. So Bill had a friend there who was guiding and invited Bill over 1 year. And I saw pictures of snow and the following year decided to go too. So went along with Bill and we stayed for 3 weeks or a little bit more than 3 weeks. And he's there working every winter now for 8 weeks guiding. And I just got to go back for a little while and ski powder.
Nice. Well, we just passed the anniversary of the earthquake there, and you were just there as well. Yeah. Did you see anything different than, I mean, this is a topic that just came out of nowhere, but it is relevant, right?
Well, in the areas that I went to ski,
there
really wasn't very much an effect at all. It was pretty far away from the places that were hit really hard. But one of the towns just north of Sendai, Ishinomaki, that I used to work in, really just got completely leveled in the tsunami and was gone. And they're rebuilding in that area now, but things still are far from being kind of back to functioning regularly.
Yeah, they've still got a lot of work on recovering. Now, another topic kind of right now and yesterday was these two skiers at the Hill Skiing in Ames that were killed, and send condolences, obviously, out to their families. Did you know the guy that was killed?
I knew of him, but I didn't actually. He wasn't a close friend or anything.
Yeah. And is it dangerous to heliski? And not just in Southeast, but around Alaska? Is this a dangerous sport?
Yes.
Yeah? I guess avalanches are dangerous, right?
I mean, we work really hard, especially with clients or when I'm with students, to be conservative in terms of our willingness to enter terrain that seems to be unstable, but there's always risk there and accidents happen and people end up dying skiing. I wouldn't say on a regular basis, but in any particular area on a regular basis, but definitely it's not something that could be considered safe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this passion for outdoor sports obviously led you, and heli-skiing led you to found or co-found Alaska Powder Descents.
Yes.
Now, was this something that was filling a niche, or just your passion led you to start a business? How did that originate?
Well, so the other owners of Alaska Powder Descents are Sean Janes and Cedar Dumont. There,
okay.
There are three of us who started the company. And actually, Sean and Cedar started the company first and invited me to kind of come on a little bit later. But I moved to Juneau about 15 years ago now, and within the first month that I was here, I met Sean on a climbing trip. I just met some people and had some kind of friends, and they were going on a climbing trip, and Sean and his Becky Janes, who were Becky Cook at the time, but they're now married, were both on that trip. And ever since then, I've kind of ended up working with Sean and Becky off and on, and they own a summer business Above and Beyond Alaska.
Okay.
And I've worked for them for quite a few years when I'm in town in the summers and when they need a guide. And I guess I should say too, there was, when I first moved to Juneau, Out of Bounds Heli-Skiing was operating here.
Okay.
And I had just started to do a little bit of work with them, and they ended up moving to Haines and kind of reopening with it's a different, slightly different company or a different organization. And then there was nobody heli-skiing in Juneau for about 6 years. And in response to that, I think Sean and Cedar decided to start this company, and I was really excited to be able to, come on board with it.
Yeah.
I think heli-skiing is a pretty amazing activity.
Yeah.
And the ability to do it, most people that I know who work as guides have to leave home for the whole heli season, and they leave their families and live someplace like Valdez for that season. And then it's just great to be able to actually have, my family here, my job here, and also be able to work as a guide.
So. Yeah. Now, do your clients for your company here come from outside the state or from mainly Southeast? What's the attraction?
Oh, from all over.
From all over, yeah.
So we had a group in from New Zealand this year and clients from Brazil this year. And then we also, for the last few years, have been getting some people shooting ski or snowboard films. And they're coming, of course, from all over the place. But our terrain here is really amazing. So it's worth coming here to do it. It's not something you can do anywhere else. Or, there are other places in Alaska, but definitely Alaska is different than most of the rest of the world in terms of the types of terrain.
Do you compete between other parts of Alaska? I mean, Valdez, South Central, does it have more of an appeal to certain skier versus Southeast?
Well, I mean, right now it seems like we're kind of the new kids. Like, we've just started really operating here again. And so other companies, and there's Valdez and Haines and Cordova.
Mm.
And all of those places have a lot of returning customers coming back and have built clientele over the years. And so people often call us and are kind of like, well, so is it good? Well, yeah, it's great. But our clients are generally really happy with the whole experience. Sometimes getting people here. I mean, Juneau's a little bit out of the way. So.
Yeah, direct.
Yeah.
Well, from Seattle, I guess. So you just spoke about working with film crews. You've been involved with PBS, Discovery Channel, and BBC. Tell us a couple examples of the projects you've done and what kind of message you've been working with through film to convey to the audiences out there.
Well, actually, when I'm working with those types of crews, I'm usually there as a safety person and sometimes a rigger or somebody who puts in ropes so that camera people can be tied in and be safe.
Okay, that's
or interesting. People can go at what the Discovery Channel wanted to do was go into moulins, big holes in the glacier where water drains out through the glacier. And so they wanted to be lowered down into those and get footage. And so,
that's quite
I was working with a few other people actually on that and trying to make it so that people can go down in dry suits with freezing cold water and go into the glacier and then get back out without, being being damaged in any way.
Wow. And, keep going.
Yeah. Well, and so, I mean, the shows themselves all have their kind of own independent message that the Discovery Channel was really trying to do kind of an adventure science type. I guess that was their focus or their kind of, you know, their draw for people. So they wanted to look at climate change type issues, but do it in a way that was, I think, you know, exciting to watch and getting people into interesting places where they might be able to see things that wouldn't normally be able to. So.
And was the audience receptive to that? Did you get feedback or?
Well, I mean, for me, and it's funny because, you know, I tell my parents, oh yeah, here's the show, and I'm in it, but it's really like, oh look, those are my boots, or I'm on the other end of that rope, and when that guy just fell, I was the person who gave him a belay and then pulled him back out.
Behind the scenes.
Always just kind of off screen a little bit, or walking through quickly in the background. In terms of, I think all the shows that we've worked on have been successful, and I know that Above and Beyond has gotten more groups contacting them or more film crews. They have a lot of film crew work that they've been doing lately. So,
and do they just find you through the website? Are they looking for guides, or have you worked with these people and had a reputation for?
Well, I think, and this would be Sean and Becky, who own that company, would be great people to ask more about this. But it's a lot of it, I think, is kind of word of mouth, right? So people that we've worked with in the past end up telling their friends. I mean, it's a pretty small community of people who do that kind of adventure-style filmmaking, and most people know each other, and then I think that Above and Beyond now has a pretty good reputation for being the company to go to in Southeast Alaska if you're interested in filming that sort of thing. So I didn't work on this project, but they had one of the kind of, it was called Man, Woman, Wild, but it, you know, wilderness survival type shows where you know, people get dropped off and have to somehow make it back to safety or live by eating strange plants they find and things like that. So they do a lot of work like that still.
Wow, that's great. Speaking of eating plants or being outside and in the outdoors, you also have a kind of another life, which is being a professor and a doctorate in philosophy, which is pretty amazing. And you kind of came here to help start a program in outdoor studies. Is that correct?
Kind of. I mean, I actually came here to take a more straightforward philosophy job.
Okay.
But when in my interview here, I noticed that University of Alaska Southeastern, you know, had no outdoor studies program at all. So they didn't offer any classes in rock climbing or kayaking, and given the environment, I was just kind of surprised.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that I'd be willing to do that, and luckily it worked out. Then my first year here, we got the opportunity to start putting those classes together, and the classes were really popular. And the following year, the chancellor asked me to put together a program, an outdoor leadership type program, and I had always had. I guess my fantasy program.
Okay, what is it,
which
Kevin?
Would be a program in which students would learn hard skills like ice climbing and rock climbing and backcountry skiing, but at the same time have academic classes that with a liberal arts focus that really help them make sense of what they're doing or think about it. So the program now that we have requires students to do all of those kind of strict outdoors courses, but then they also take a literature in the environment course and a philosophy course called Perspectives in the Natural World that looks at how different groups of people consider human relationship with nature and that sort of thing.
Excellent.
They take a class called Sport, Leisure, and Culture in which they really kind of consider the role of sport in their lives personally, but also in society, and that sort of thing, and the idea is that when students graduate from the program, they they can think in really sophisticated ways about what they're doing and why they're doing it. I guess
yeah.
And part of it was a little bit self-focused as well. I've since I was very young, I've really been interested in skiing. I've just been kind of, most of my life has been devoted to it, or at least a large part of it. And I've always been kind of curious as to why, and, you know, what's the attraction there, what's going on.
So you want to explore that.
And yeah, so personally, it was really that sort of thing. You know, why am I interested in climbing? Why am I interested in skiing? But very quickly, I mean, that can be turned into questions that aren't relevant to just my life, but just general questions as well, in terms of looking at other people and looking at culture and how we think about sports. And, you know, it's probably the same for anybody in a field that they are interested in and enjoy, but the more you look, the more questions kind of open up, and there is to think about.
And your relationship to the environment as well, right?
Exactly,
and
yeah.
The problems in our environment.
Uh-huh.
Changes in our world. Like you said, climate change. Adventure science, they call it. But, I mean, it's so surprising to hear, I guess, this whole outdoor philosophy, because, I don't know, do you find a lot of other outdoor enthusiasts are as reflective as you are?
No. There are some.
Yeah.
And some of the people some of the people at Alaska Pattern Sense are very, I mean, one of the reasons I think that I've gotten along pretty well with at least Sean, who I've known the longest time, as kind of a partner that I work with there, was because we've always been able to have conversations about that sort of thing, and I've always, you know, because I've been drawn to people who participate in outdoor things and can also have conversations or talk about it. And so, I mentioned him. Also, Bill Glue, who I mentioned going to Japan with, is someone else who I've really kind of just enjoyed spending time with and reflecting on what we're doing.
And as you reflect, you come up with other topics fuel your, your classes. You've had a hand in creating these classes at UAS, right?
Oh, yes.
So you've seen them evolve and the interest from students become more involved, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and the students who are, especially students who are in our 4-year programs at the university, I get teased a little bit by people like, you're making other versions of yourself, or students who are kind of doing something that replicates what I do. But I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily. So.
No, of course not. Wow. So, but have some of the programs you created here been exported outside of Southeast? Have you gone and spoken about some of these programs, or inspired others to create them?
Not really. I don't think that the program. I mean, it's hard to replicate. But one of the great things. It's like, this sounds a little bit like a sales pitch, but one of the things that I often say to the administration at UAS when we talk about whether or not they should give money to the outdoor studies program is that we have a setting here where we can do so much, and other schools that have a lot more resources than we do can't really compete with what we can do here, because we can offer students, you know, whitewater kayaking, sea kayaking, skiing, ice climbing, mountaineering, all really within the vicinity of the school. And then when we access things in the rest of the state, we can just do really incredible things with students that make their university, their time at university, really meaningful to them. Mm-hmm. So.
Or future entrepreneurs in a company related to sports, right?
Oh, definitely.
Outdoor sports.
Yeah, I mean, I don't tend to think about things in terms of economic development as much as some people would.
Chancellor Pugh wants to see.
I think of it more in terms of philosophical development or something like that.
Yeah, which is very important.
And so our program would be hard to recreate somewhere else. I mean, I often think about that too. Whenever I think about other places I might want to work, it always, the idea kind of goes away quickly, because there really wouldn't, it'd be hard to find this kind of setup anywhere else.
Definitely. Dr. Kevin Krein. If you're just tuning in, Dr. Kevin Krein is co-founder of Alaska Powder Descents, as well as associate professor of philosophy at the University of Alaska Southeast, working with outdoor studies. Now, you also have written, published, and presented on this topic. I mean, the list goes on and on, but I did pull out a couple that were very interesting. For example, the presentation called Sport, Nature, and the Metaphysics of World Making at the 34th Annual Meeting of the International Association for the Philosophy of Sport. Tell us a little bit about this metaphysics of world making and also what this international group does. It was in Canada, right?
Well, the International Association for Philosophy of Sport involves actually not just philosophers, but academics who work in related fields from all over the world. And philosophy of sport is actually a little bit, I think, more popular in Europe and in Asia than it is in North America. And so often that group ends up meeting, they have a setup where they meet in North America one year and then in someplace else and alternate, and it kind of goes around the world. So I think in September I'm going to a conference in Portugal that I'm excited about. Yeah. But that particular paper, I actually published it a little bit later as a journal article. And I mean, as I see sport, I mean, most people participate in or watch sport. I mean, sport plays a huge part in people's lives, and so it makes sense to think that it influences how we see the world, right? And and that's not a new thing to say. A lot of people have said that before. But what I kind of wanted to point out is there's a difference between traditional sports that are usually thought of as competitive. I mean, if you think, you know, like football is a classic case, or basketball, track, baseball, and these kind of competitive ideas or competitive sports where there are a standardized set of rules that have to be followed with penalties, and it's all about kind of who can win. And then sports like skiing or surfing or climbing or skateboarding, where it's a lot more difficult to explain what the purpose of the sport is and why people are doing it, and people have their own goals, and a lot of people never compete at all. And a lot of people say that their attraction to those sports is that they didn't want to compete. They wanted to do something that was different. And so what I argued in that paper was that I just kind of made that point, I guess.
Yeah.
And then said that I think it's healthy in our culture to have sports that kind of facilitate alternative ways of looking at the world. Because if you think of the world as something like a football game, you're going to see it really differently than if you think of the world as something like a day out skiing.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's the metaphysics of world making. That's very cool. So these are called the nature sports. That's what you say. What are nature sports and why are they important? Which was another paper you did, or went to the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association. Do people invite you? Do they hear about some of your work, your publishings, and invite you, or do you seek out places to kind of spread the message?
A little bit of both. The one that you just mentioned at the American Philosophical Association, that was an invited paper last year, and then I also was at a conference during the summer where I gave a keynote address, so people kind of found me and had read stuff that I'd done, and so invited me to come and talk. And that was a conference on sport and environment.
Okay.
And so it's a little bit of both. Recently, I've been getting invited to do things more, probably within the last 4 years or so. I think before that, it was always me saying, oh, here, I can present on this. Please let me.
Well, that's for the academic world too, right?
Yeah. I mean, with my academic job, part of it is, I mean, I'm required to publish and required to present work. So
Kevin, the other side, besides what we started out talking about, Alaska Putter Descents, you obviously are an avid outdoor enthusiast and skier, and you, according to Zach, he told me you summited to Denali, and you were crazy to have carried up your skis and then skied down. He's never known anyone to do that. And if you want to tell that story, why did you carry your skis all the way up to the top of Denali?
Well, I mean, the only reason that I went there was to ski down, actually.
Okay.
I mean, I've kind of... This isn't always the case, but in general, if I'm looking at something and thinking about climbing it, it's because I want to ski down it.
Okay.
So that was the idea. I think carrying skis on a mountain like that is much easier, actually, than walking up and turning around and walking back down. It's a lot. I mean, it's a faster, more efficient way to get down. It requires different types of skills, I guess. But so that trip... It actually took a few years from the time back in the this was the mid-90s. There were a lot of, I guess, extreme skiing competitions, or these kind of what have now become big mountain free skiing competitions, and they had just started, and I started getting involved in those, and then kind of related to that, I ended up getting invited to go on a few trips into the Alaska Range to go try to ski stuff, and then developed this idea with a friend of mine that we wanted to ski down Denali, and so decided that we needed to take a little bit of time, and it wasn't until 2 years later that we actually did it, but it was fun. I mean, we skied a lot of other stuff on kind of thinking about doing that, and it was really a great experience.
What a trip. And then down in South America, what I consider my second home in Chile, you went up Aconcagua, which at the time I didn't realize Aconcagua was the second outside of Everest, and that whole range, largest in the world, actually larger than Denali or higher than Denali.
Yes, it's the highest in the Western Hemisphere.
Hemisphere. So, and it's a little less extreme than Denali, right? Easier to climb?
Yes. I mean, there's certainly the normal route on Aconcagua is very straightforward, and there's not really as much glacier travel, and the weather isn't as harsh as Denali. For me, I again was hoping to ski down, and so carried skis all the way to the top.
Oh, you did the same.
And then it ended up just being kind of late in the day, and the weather started to kind of turn a little bit, and my partner, who was also with me on Denali, was just kind of like, yeah, this maybe doesn't make sense. And then I kind of, yeah, he was absolutely right. And so turned around and carried all of my stuff back down. And then, I think that actually, the high camp on Aconcagua was about just over 19,000 feet. And then we left the next day and went back up a little ways and then traversed and came down the other side. And my pack was so heavy because I had skis and ski boots and climbing boots and some light shoes and a bunch of other stuff.
It was a
good trip. It was really, it was great. And then it was one of those things, too, where we had been climbing for a couple of weeks, and then within a day we're down in nice warm weather, and spent another few weeks in a little bit of time in Argentina and some time in Chile as well.
It's a beautiful country.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope to go back. Well, Kevin, you've done a lot. I really thank you for taking the time to come on the show today and explain a little bit more about not only Alaska Powder Descents, which you co-founded, and maybe we'll get Sean James on here the next time to tell us some more stories, but also for your work with students and really impacting people with philosophy of sport and outdoor studies. And I wish you the best of luck continuing with that.
Wow, well, thanks a lot. This has been great.
Yeah, Dr. Kevin Krine. Of course, you can go on the internet and find out more about him. You can Google Alaska Powder Descents and UAS faculty as well. So take care. Next up, we will have Katie Hurley. She is in the Alaska Women's Hall of Fame for her service, over 60 years of public service in Alaska. We'll be talking with her about her impact at 92 years old. So stay tuned here on the Alaska Identity Project.
Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Adrienne Lopez here on the Alaska Identity Project. Thanks for staying tuned here tonight. Thanks to Martha Moore here in the studio for a great job as studio engineer. We're back with the second half-hour guest, which I feel very, very lucky to have in the studio tonight. Her name is Katie Hurley, and she was born on Seward's Day here in Juneau and has devoted her life to public service in the state of Alaska. She started her career as the assistant to Territorial Governor Ernest Greening for 12 years and then served as the chief clerk to the Constitutional Convention and then as secretary of the Territorial Senate and the State Senate after statehood for Alaska. Later, she was elected to the State House of Representatives from Wasilla, where she has resided since 1960. Hurley was the first woman to win a statewide partisan election when she was a Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor in 1978. She has also served as the executive director of the Alaska Commission on the Status of Women, the chair of the Alaska Commission on Human Rights, president of the State Board of Education, a member of the Alaska Judicial Council, and on the Matanuska Telephone Board. She shares her time and encyclopedic knowledge of public affairs in Alaska with students across the state. Katie, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And being in Juneau, how does it feel to be back in your hometown?
I love it. I'm always so pleased that there are not that many changes, so it still looks like home. When I was walking from my home on 12th Street to school and going by the governor's mansion and remembering that at the time that I was a young student, the mansion was there, but we never saw anybody because the governor at a lot of those years was a single man, and and it was like wondering what it's like, what is inside. And then, of course, when Ernest Greening became governor, he really opened it up to the public, and of course, I started working in his office the first. He'd been governor for a year when I was hired to be a clerk stenographer.
Wow! And how did you get this job? Was it a notice in the paper?
Oh no, I was enlisted with an agency that was looking, you know, where you could apply, and the person in charge took a liking to me, and he sent me out on several jobs where I did okay, but they ran out of money. And so and the day that I went for the test and I didn't know what the test was going to be, but when I got there, the test was taking dictation from the governor. And there were two other women in the room, and one of them was someone I'd been in high school with, and she had won every contest in the taking shorthand, and I thought, oh, this is going to be, I'll never make it. But I did get the job.
And you worked for 12 years.
Yes.
Under Greening. What was that like working under him? How was he as a person?
Well, the first 6 months, you know, for me was just getting used to the office, but he was very wonderful about explaining things and made me feel comfortable to ask questions. I mean, he had a degree. He was a medical doctor, and he'd had...
From Harvard.
All kinds, yes, and all kinds of experiences. And here I was, someone who had been educated in Juneau schools. I had had 1 year at a business college in Portland, Oregon. But he was so great to make me feel comfortable. And Stell Draper, who was his chief of staff, she told me that if I didn't understand anything, that I should be sure to ask questions. And that was very helpful, that she made me feel comfortable that I could do that. And so sometimes when I'd ask a question, he would give me more information than I really needed, because he was a very educated.
Very educated man. So you worked under Governor Greening, and then you also were taking minutes for the Constitutional Convention at the time.
No, not at the time.
Not that time.
No,
okay.
I worked for the governor for 12 years, and then there was a at that time, the governor was appointed by the administration, and the Democrats lost president, and a Republican came in, and so he was no longer governor.
Uh-huh.
And then I worked as for the legislature during the sessions, but I didn't have a permanent job for those years. And then with the fight for statehood, then the governor got involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And then went to Washington when we became a state.
Wow.
But I never worked for him after he was governor, which was, the term was up, can't think of the year now.
That's all right.
But it was 12 years from the time I started in December of 1940, and the election of 52, I think it was, when the Republicans became in charge in Washington, D.C., and that's when, that was the end of my working there. But by that time, I had my son, and I was married, and so I just worked as a clerk for the legislative sessions, which at that time were only 60 days.
60? And they complain about, wow, so at one time it doubled then, 120 and then 90. Huh. So, but then later on, the Constitutional Convention, you worked with this, and actually a question that came from Sally Smith was why, what were the reasons they decided to go to Fairbanks in the middle of the winter?
I was hired by they got their staff together. Tom Stewart was a friend. We'd been raised together. He was a few years older than I, but he had worked with me, and I had been Secretary of the Senate and had worked in the legislature. I was Secretary of the Senate the year that they passed the bill to call for the Constitutional Convention. The legislature had not acted then, they would have had to wait until the Congress passed the statehood bill, and then the federal government would have paid for it. But the 1955 legislature was very forward-looking and had the votes, and they decided that the territory would pay for it. The Constitutional Convention, and they called it and paid for it. And it was a helpful move towards making the Congress think clearer and more enthusiastic for the fact that we could control our future.
Yeah, be independent.
And that was a very, very wonderful experience. I mean, the people who were elected, some of them were professional people, but there were a lot of people who had never served in any kind of organization like that, and the leadership came together and wrote a constitution that still is applauded for being very progressive.
Wow.
And it was, I took the minutes, just the action items. It wasn't verbatim. They had tapes going, though, all the time, so that there is still in the records of the state the sessions that were recorded. But I just took the actions items, and I had an assistant, and I was there, and I had a typewriter in my apartment, so if the session went on longer than the days, and there was a bus that came back and forth, and if I had to take the bus when it left, so I had a typewriter in my apartment, and towards the end, I was up transcribing minutes.
Wow.
Till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and then took them out, and the staff then mimeographed them for the delegates to see.
That's amazing.
But it never seemed like work. It was so
really?
I knew this was a very unusual experience for someone like me to have that insight and to be there with. And it was fascinating, to look back to remember how some of the people came there with very little experience, but they all became statesmen as far as the goal that they had, which was to write the best constitution, which is still looked at as being a model.
And you were a part of that.
Democracy.
Yeah, of course. Now, what do you think was your most important contribution there with Alaska statehood?
Beg your pardon?
What do you think was an important contribution for Alaska statehood? How did you contribute in that sense? I mean, did you ever get to give your opinion at all?
No. No.
proceedings?
Well, I think my enthusiasm and my sincerity that people recognized, and we were all working together. I mean, nobody was thinking about making a lot of money. We're just, the goal was to write a good constitution.
Yeah.
And my goal was to do the job for them, to make it easier, to be sure that everything was accurate.
That's an amazing role, Katie.
I was very, very lucky.
Yeah. Wow. So, changing topics a little bit, later on, I found online that you also were able to meet President Kennedy when he was here in Alaska, before he became president. What was that experience?
Oh, he came up to do some campaigning for Bob Bartlett, who was running for re-election to Congress. And I have this picture of me with him and Bob Bartlett and Catherine Nordahl, who was the National Committee Woman for the Democratic Party. And what everybody thinks when they see it is that, you know, I am absolutely, you know, like a teenager looking at...
off of starstruck?
Yeah. But to me, I had just given birth 7 weeks before to my daughter, and I had this knit dress on, and I was so proud of the fact that I had a flat stomach.
That's important.
And I was not a young mother either. You know, I was in my late 30s, and so that's the thing about the picture that I love. But I am telling you, I'll show it to you someday, because it's just, I look like a teenager just,
with
you
President
know.
Kennedy.
And that was, he wasn't running for president when he made that trip. He was, I'm sure he was thinking about it, but he did it for his friendship with Bob Bartlett, and who was running for re-election to Congress.
Wow. I'll have to find that picture somewhere.
Yeah.
Katie, you also served as executive director of the Alaska Commission on the Status of Women, which, of course, you've been influential woman in our state over the history of the time you've been here, your whole life. How have you seen kind of women's issues change? I mean, from the time you were working there with the Constitutional Convention to up until now, what are some reflections on that?
Well, it was very progressive of the legislature to have a commission on the status of women at that time. And I was fortunate to, I wasn't the first executive director, but I had an excellent staff of just three women, and we're still friends.
Really?
We still communicate, even though they don't all live in Alaska, because the work that we did, there was a board that we had who made the decisions, and then we carried them out. But it was an eye-opener for a lot of people who didn't realize how women had not been promoted as much as they were able to be. Mm-hmm. And I wish that they hadn't taken it somebody's trying to get it back. I think one of the legislators has been thinking that we still need a women's commission to be sure that women are treated equally and don't get left out of the opportunities that are there. And it was we had a very small budget, so most of the, and there was a board made up of women from across the territory, and it was, I mean, the state then, and we were a state then, but they were very progressive, and it was very rewarding. Some of the, I'm still in contact with the three people that were my staff. We get together still, although only one of them lives in Alaska.
Oh. You still reflect back on that time?
Yeah, we do.
Nice. Now, speaking of reflections, you're actually in Juneau for the, tomorrow they are, let me look at the title, there's a historical celebration to honor generations of Alaskan women legislators as part of National Women's History Month, actually. It's Women's History Month. You served in the legislature in the 80s. We were just talking about this, right? Made you decide to run?
One term. Well, some friends of mine pushed me to do it, and I wasn't sure that that was where I wanted to be, but I did go along because I thought maybe that was someplace where I could make a difference. But when I'm a staunch Democrat, and when the legislature convened, the Democrats didn't have a majority. Mm. Well, they had 18 Democrats, and I think there were 22 Republicans. And so the leadership got two Republicans to be part of the Democratic so that we would have the votes to override any kind of votes that, you know, where you needed to have it, because the Democrats had not elected a majority. And that just, for me, was it took away all of the interest, I mean, the real issues for me. And so I was the chair of the State Affairs Committee, and I had a chance to promote some things, but it wasn't what I had expected it to be after all the years that I'd been Secretary of the Senate in the legislature, and had seen how action was. And so I didn't mind the fact that I didn't get reelected.
Oh, you didn't go back. Wow. So, Katie, you are turning, is it 92 at the end of this month?
On 91.
March? 91, okay. You don't want to push the years anymore. On Seward's Day, which is quite...
Yeah.
Interesting.
I was born in Juneau, too.
In Juneau. What's still left to do for you? What's on your bucket list, as they call it, at 91?
Oh, I don't know that I still want to be involved, but, you know, I'm still concerned about issues that have to do with children, and I have... two daughters and four grandchildren who are growing up in Alaska, and so I still have an interest in the issues that will involve them. But also, I'm just a Democratic, I can't think of the right word but right now, but I'm enthusiastically always involved in as far as the good government and so forth. I just hope that my brain keeps going so that I don't end up having to be in a rest home.
Oh, no. Let's hope not. Well, remembering things on a radio show like this is good, having to think back and tell your story, which is very important. Did you ever, I mean, you lived in Alaska your whole life. Did you ever consider, okay, I want to go live somewhere else outside of the state? Or
never.
Just this was your place?
Mm-hmm. And the thing that I was so fortunate to have was a love of music, and I had a wonderful piano teacher who instilled in me that. So I'm never alone because I have music, and I have my piano, and I use it in the way that it makes life very full. And and also when I was young, 12 years old, my father had always taken me to the library in Juneau, and the librarian became very fond of me and trained me in how to shelve the books, and I worked for like 25 cents an hour in the summertime, and she had a garden and would go. She actually left me in charge of the public, letting the, and I was like 13 years old, checking out books, and she'd go to work in her garden for a couple of hours in the summertime, and I'd help with the inventory, and that was a great gift that she gave me, because when you have books and the opportunity to broaden yourself that way, it's very rewarding.
Yeah.
But that was because Juneau was a small town, I got 25 cents an hour when she left me there in charge of the library. And, of course, I loved it when my friends would come in and I'd be the one stamping their books.
At 13 years old. Wow, Katie. Well, Juneau is...
I mean, you couldn't do that nowadays.
No.
With the laws. And so
child labor. Well, unfortunately, we're almost out of time. But I really want to thank you for not only coming on the show, but just your lifetime.
Oh, I don't know that I'm...
Service.
I'm getting too old to remember the wonderful things. And if I don't write everything down, I wrote a few notes. But I think we did talk about some of the things that were important.
Well, good. Well, we'll have to...
And I thank you for having me by.
Of course. Well, I was originally going to call you from Wasilla, I remember, and have an interview over the phone, so maybe I could do a follow-up later on.
Okay.
And congratulations, tomorrow you'll be in the historical celebration of honoring generations of Alaskan women legislators, and thanks for inspiring all of us and being a role model for all women and men. So thanks. Katie Hurley. This is the Alaska Identity Project. My name's Adrienne Lopez. Thanks for listening tonight. We'll be back again next Thursday here on KTOO News Juneau. Take care.